The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
Today, we talk about the missing middle, what it is, and how it can help address Vancouver's housing crisis. And here's something I want to mention. I told a friend that today's episode is on housing, and she said, "What? Again? Haven't you done a bunch of episodes on housing?" And we have. We've done a number of interviews on housing, and we're going to keep doing that. The reason why we keep coming back to housing is because that it is clear there is no single solution to our housing crisis. And that means as a city, we'll have to discuss lots of different partial solutions. And here's the important thing. The deeper question underneath all of these policy questions is, what do we want our city to look like? And someone who's thought a lot about this is Bruce Hayden. Bruce serves on the board of Urbanarium, a nonprofit that looks at the design of cities, and Urbanarium put out a report about how missing middle housing units can help with providing housing to people in our city. Yes, this conversation is about housing, but it's also a conversation about how we want to live, what makes us happy, and how we can design our city's housing strategy to help Vancouverites be more fulfilled in our lives. This is part one of our two-part conversation. Here's Bruce. Hey, Bruce Hayden, what a pleasure to have you on the show today. In this report, you said we can't just add housing to Vancouver and expect housing in general to be more affordable, to be cheaper for folks. Why is that?
Well, we've added a whole bunch of housing to the city of Vancouver recently, and it actually hasn't brought the housing costs down. Housing prices are continuing to escalate. Some of that is external factors like immigration for sure, but our focus with this particular report was what we call the missing middle. If you think of most housing in Vancouver, it's either the single family house or towers. What we were interested in is what are the financial design regulation barriers that get in the way of people doing little townhouse projects, those small apartment buildings that make the old turn of the century streetscape so livable. And the challenge is that if I'm building a big tower, I've got a lot of market-based units that I can add on to and make the finances work to give some affordable units. If I'm just building four units, it's much harder to make that math work.
So you're saying that in a condo, you know, if you've got already 50 units, you add 10 more units, it brings the price down. But when we're working something like a townhome, you know, if we've got a small number of townhomes, say maybe 10 homes, adding four doesn't really change the math. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's a little bit like that. But if you look closely at the math, I won't go into all the details. The problem is you have to find a way to effectively provide a subsidy to make housing units more affordable. You have to find a way to take them out of the market. So for example, BC Housing can just fund a project and create a bunch of affordable housing units. So you're taking taxpayers' money, putting money into a project, and saving money for the eventual residents of the project. That's one way to do it. If you want to try to use the existing market to do that, you need a building that's big enough to generate enough excess profit that you can take that money and put it into subsidizing the other units. That's possible on a big scale. It's harder on a very small scale, on the kind of missing middle scale of four or five or six units, simply because you don't have enough market units to create enough extra money to create a subsidy.
Maybe if you can elaborate a little more about why extra supply doesn't reduce the price. Because I think maybe if we break it down, if we think about, you know, blueberries in season, when there's lots of blueberries during the summer, the price goes down for blueberries. Looking at that in a housing context, so I was born in Singapore and the entire island is covered in apartment buildings. You know, we may not all want to live in apartment buildings and that's very rational. But in that sense, that's a country that's added a bunch of units to make homes a little more affordable. So why, could you break it down for us even further?
The Singapore example is an interesting one because in Singapore, the government is a very, very deeply engaged in the housing market. Like a lot of the units are actually provided almost at cost by the government, and they have much more control over land use than we do. And it's not that Singapore is not a market economy, but it's a more of an interventionist, like a government as an intervener. And here in a more pure market economy, what happens is that we need to find other ways to provide housing. And the problem, one of the problems in this region is that, yes, we've created a lot more housing, but it's not always the right type of housing. When the city of Vancouver did an analysis, for example, they said we're building too many Lexuses and not enough Toyotas. So, and some of the reason for that is the market forces are pushing more and more towards this luxury product. Now, one of the interesting things that's happening right now is that that's changing, is that it's becoming more and more logical from a straight financial perspective to build rental housing. And some of that is the government, including groups like CMHC, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, and BC Housing, have created some programs that actually have supported the creation of rental housing. Often market rental, some subsidized rental, but it's absolutely true for rental housing perspective that as you expand the market, then rents will tend to go down. If you look at what happened, for example, when they reduced the, made it much more hard to Airbnb, a bunch of new rental units came on the market and rents started to actually stabilize and go down. So the answer to your question is sometimes. Sometimes increasing supply will make things cheaper, but not always. Housing is very complex. What we need, we kind of need all sorts of different types of housing. You're absolutely correct that one of our greatest resources, the reason we focused on the missing middle, if you think about it, from the first thing you need for housing is you need land. And the biggest access to land in our region is still the single family neighborhoods. We don't want to start paving over the agricultural land reserve. We can't go south of the American border. We can't go into the ocean. We can't go into the mountains very easily. So what we need to do is take that underutilized resource, which is a bunch of often single family homes, actually not even fully occupied single family homes. You know, they're either partially used or used by only very small numbers of people. So some of it is how do we take that land base and use it more effectively? And what we tried to do is look at all the barriers to that. And one of them is financial, but some of that is the rules of the game that the city imposes as well.
Right. So then now we bump up against the classic problem of, look, there's land in single family zoned neighborhoods, but the folks who are comfortably living in single family zoned neighborhoods don't want multi-unit homes. Mm-hmm. And so let's go into the first policy recommendation that you put out in the report, and which is to rezone broadly. Could you describe what you mean by rezoning broadly and how we could address the concerns of single family homeowners?
I don't know if we're ever completely overcome the objectives of homeowners to rezoning, but one of the ways to make it easier is if you think about it, if I'm a developer and I want to do a small little affordable housing project, currently I'm going to have a massive fight on my hands to do that project if it's in a single family neighborhood. And the economics and the personal stress of it, to be honest, because some of it is you'll get people, you know, calling you all sorts of nasty names, will be, so that's a real barrier. Whereas if the city said, we want as a mass matter of policy to allow these kinds of buildings to be built, and we don't want to have a single fight where we just are fighting over the corner at Fifth and Collingwood or whatever. We actually want to say that this is something we're going to do across the whole city. That has a couple of advantages. One is that it's fair. You're not saying to a particular corner, you're going to have more density, and the other one is and you're just saying across the city, this is part of a responsibility to each other is to provide housing. And we all benefit if we actually have a good range of housing available. So that's a really important thing. The other thing is you don't take a chunk of land and suddenly escalate the land values because you're rezoning over a very, very large area. And there is a limit to the amount because of the availability of development resources, availability of construction resources. You can't build everywhere at once. So what happens in that case, we talked about supply and demand, is the housing prices, the land prices won't go up if you rezone across the whole city. But primarily it's because you're not having a single fight around every single unit. You're having a broader civic conversation about what are responsibilities with respect to creating more housing.
Right, because the current status quo, what is happening now is whenever there is a rezoning of a particular unit in a particular building, mm-hmm. we spend lots and lots of time debating in city council, and lots of often angry neighbors get together and say they either oppose or approve of the zoning. But I guess let me poke a little bit, Bruce, because what you're saying here is it's not anything new. You know, folks have been saying rezone broadly for a long time. or to my understanding, rezone changed single family home zoning into something that allows for more multifamily dwellings. So I guess, can you enlighten me here? Like, what is the, what are we adding to the conversation with this note in the report?
I think what shifted in our view, and one of the reasons that we thought a missing middle competition was timely, is that people are starting to see the real costs associated with not having the right kind of housing. And the way I think about it is that there are people now who've lived comfortably in their West Side family homes, and suddenly their kids can't afford a house anywhere close to them. Their kids having to buy in Coquitlam or in Chilliwack or in Hope or in Kelowna, and so they don't get to see their grandkids. But some of the costs of this are visceral, like the costs of having schools in your neighborhood that aren't fully, that aren't occupied with kids, all of those kinds of things. You know, I always find it astonishing to drive through the West Side at moments and you just often don't see anybody on the street. So there are some real visceral costs to neighborhoods that are, in some cases in our neighborhoods, are actually declining in population. It makes it much harder to have retail stores, to have restaurants, all of those kinds of things. So some of it is people are seeing the challenges. But I don't want to be Pollyannish, as I say, that just makes the thing go away. I think it's more just that we're recognizing is that, to be honest, in many cases we've made a societal decision that single family homes are in some way a kind of morally superior form of housing, and that they should be protected is often the term. I actually think that's the wrong decision. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a single family house, but it isn't the best way to think about it is that what we need is a great mix of housing, and we've sanitized huge chunks of the city by having just one type of housing. And that's been a mistake, because it means that young couples can't move in. It means single people can't move in. If we want to have a flourishing city economically and a flourishing city socially, we have to have a huge range of housing. We haven't done that effectively.
So let's take this conversation and move it to something that's quite concrete. Portland did something with zoning that was quite interesting, and it got a lot of people who are interested in housing policy quite excited. Can you explain what Portland did and why it was so special?
Portland did exactly what we're suggesting we do here, which is they basically suggested that there wouldn't, that they would allow infill development on all single family lots.
What's infill development?
Oh, sorry, infill development. Thank you. A geeky word. Infill development. So an infill is a laneway house, for example, is an example of an infill development. So you've got a main house, and what you're doing is you're adding to the main house in some way or another. You're adding units to an existing property. So you're not completely necessarily rebuilding a property. You're not building on a brand new site. You're building on a site with existing buildings. So they said, we're gonna allow more than one unit everywhere in the city. And yes, it was a fight for sure, but it had exactly the advantage where they had a broad discussion about housing policy rather than a site-by-site guerrilla war, which was completely exhausting. And it was a real good policy. And other cities around North America have started to do the same thing.
Bruce, does this give you hope? To what degree is it possible in Vancouver, you think? Because Mayor Kennedy Stewart tried to put in something similar, and there was criticism saying that it was not quite similar to Portland model, there were things off about it. But I guess I'll let you fill in the details here. And my broader question to you is that, does seeing Portland, which is a city fairly close to us, pass a zoning bylaw like this or zoning change like this, does it give you hope that Vancouver could do something similar?
It does. And Kenny Stewart's initiative was a positive one. One of the critical challenges is we still have enormous political capital invested in people living in existing neighborhoods who want to protect, and I don't like the word protect, their neighborhoods. And some of that is based on fallacy, but the reality is that one of the unfortunate things about our political system is that the people who would live in a neighborhood if they had the option to don't get a voice. The people who've lived in the neighborhood for a long time do get a voice, and that voice is often loud and angry.
And I just want to interject here, Bruce, with an anecdote, because I think it's quite relevant. I had a friend of mine who now lives in Surrey. And a year ago, when the city of Vancouver started their citywide planning process, when they asked for lots of people to fill out their surveys and they wanted to get all sorts of feedback, and my friend from Surrey tried to fill in the survey. and put in his postal code. And the website recognized that, well, he doesn't live in Vancouver and wouldn't fill out a survey. But he said, I would sure live in Vancouver if only I could afford to. And so I guess that's the, and that little bit of that, just that little anecdote, that little experience of what he has, is what you're saying, like on a larger scale, is how our housing conversation is structured.
Yeah, it's exactly true. It's the people who are on the ground in the current situation, in many cases who had extraordinary privilege, and I think we have to acknowledge that, have way more say in how housing gets developed than the people who want to live here.
Despite the political challenges, could you offer any advice from all the planning work you've done to city councillors and elected folks thinking about this? How do I get a zoning bylaw passed? Do you have recommendations here?
Well, we've looked at several things. We've talked about the importance of rezoning broadly. The other thing that I think is important is to look at some of the little funny little details. And I'm actually going to talk about a thing that's not a funny little detail at all, which is parking. One of the problems with doing building on any small lot scenario is the way our current laws are written is you have to really design for the car first and people second. And the reason you need to do that is that cars are bigger than people. And we have a principle that if you have, let's say, 4 units on a piece of land, you should provide 4 parking spaces. I think that's a tragic error. I think it's a tragic error because we shouldn't encourage parking use. I think it reduces the opportunity for good design. And the last thing is that it also, not providing parking for unit means that it's less likely to be subject to market forces. So the unit without a parking stall will always rent for cheaper than a unit with a parking stall. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Depending on your type of underground parking, it costs between $50,000 and $100,000 to build a space for a parking stall.
Wait, one parking stall?
One parking stall.
Why does it cost that much?
Because mostly, again, if I'm talking about bigger buildings for a moment, obviously if you're just graveling over a piece of grass, it's cheaper than that. But in bigger buildings, what happens is you're digging a hole. Concrete is expensive. You have to provide all the ramping. Cars are big. All of these kinds of things. It's extremely expensive to do it. And I just do not believe that the way we should spend any resources we can have in getting better housing is housing cars. If people want to buy space for their car and they want to pay $100,000, absolutely. But we should have tons of opportunities where you don't have to do that.
And so to be clear, the city of Vancouver is rethinking its parking minimums. I think to the last time I checked, city council has asked city staff to come back with a report later this year, asking city staff to look at what it would mean for the city of Vancouver to not have parking minimums. Do you have confidence that we'll see change soon?
We will absolutely see change. I'm less confident about soon than I used to be. I mean, I've been beating the drum around eliminating parking as a requirement for about 15 years now, and it hasn't been part of the conversation to date. But some of this is, you know, I am optimistic in some ways that we have to have more societal conversations about, instead of what are our privileges, but what are our responsibilities to each other. And if my ability to park right in front of my single family house is seen as an absolute right, then that's actually a tragedy, because it reduces so many options to open up the neighborhood in ways that would be dramatically beneficial, including to myself. One of the things we've done is make convenience the most important thing. I don't think convenience is the most important thing. I think the most important thing is how well do we treat each other.
And I do want to talk about the other sort of odd sounding details, policy details, recommendations in the report that, again, don't sound like much, but the report states that there is actually a fair amount of benefit. And for example, one of them is they're reducing the required setbacks of a unit and increasing allowable height. And correct me if I'm wrong, but to my understanding, it means allowing folks to build bigger buildings or bigger homes on a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things is that, yes, it allows you to build bigger buildings, but also allows you to use the land more effectively. In cross-culture, there are a ton of different ways of building housing. You described the process in Singapore where it's all towers. We're not suggesting that. If you look at, there's a number of streets in East Vancouver, for example, where the distance between the front doors of the houses is 120, 130, 140 feet. There's a ton of extra space there. Often it's not used by kids playing because there aren't kids in the neighborhood. Some of it is used for nice planting. Not all of it is. Why don't we start to imagine the ways that those sorts of spaces can be used just more efficiently? And one of our responsibilities, I speak a lot about responsibility in this, is that we can't just continue to spread our cities out, right? So part of it is we need to make ways to make better use of the land we got. And you can design absolutely beautiful streetscapes that are much narrower than that. We're not talking about making the city ugly or anything like that. We're just talking about a different kind of urbanism. Like if you go to London or Paris or New York, there's all of the beautiful brownstones where the houses are actually quite close together. It's not necessary to have a massive space between houses to create great livable places for people to stay.
Bruce, I hear the beauty in that vision, but I want to push back a little bit here about what we've seen happen in the real world when we've seen homes getting built, according to some folks, too large and a little too close to the other lots. It hasn't been that long ago when we heard about the monster homes debate, it was a very culturally divisive issue when folks of different backgrounds built homes, filled them with their relatives and extended family members, and neighbors on either side complained that the homes were too loud, too large, and too close to their own homes. How do we balance both housing people effectively and also managing the real concerns of neighbors?
Oh, absolutely, and I think it's a fair conversation. So part of it is, I think it's really important to allow, one of the benefits of having a bunch of different types of housing, it allows a bunch of people to arrange their families the way they want to. So for example, until very recently, you weren't, actually I'm not even sure whether it's still on the books, in the city of Vancouver, you weren't allowed to have more than, I think it's five, I'm not sure, five people living together under one roof that weren't related. And in my mind, that is a direct barrier to people. Like, I don't think it's my job to tell any of my neighbors how they want to live. I just don't. It's absolutely reasonable that we have noise bylaws. It's absolutely reasonable that we have, you know, that property maintenance rules, all of those kinds of things. It's not reasonable that we get to tell other people how to build their families.
And that was Bruce Hayden. Bruce serves on the board of Urbanarium, and we talked about how building missing middle homes can help with Vancouver's housing crisis. This was part one of our two-part conversation. Tune in tomorrow for part two. And that's it for today. You're listening to The Pulse and CFRO, your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Macy, and as always, please tell us what you think of the show. I'm at Macy@coopradio.org. That's M-E-I-X-I at coopradio.org. Ciao. Take care.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.